That is the Wall Street protest crowd you never heard on TV. Well, one reporter in a nice suit spoke over them, never offering a microphone to the public to see what they would say. That is the operation of the mainstream media. People making seven-figure salaries, working for multi-billion dollar media companies, discuss the ups and downs of their stock portfolios. And they are all pushing the bailout, a huge loan from the next generation, the young people already eyeball deep in credit card debt and student loans. Presidential candidate John McCain, with his multi-millionaire wife Cindy, speaks for the super rich. Barack Obama says repeatedly he represents the middle class. The rest of the Americans, the working poor, the sick, the homeless, they have no candidate. In fact, they don't appear in this election at all. They are millions of invisible people for whom the stock market gyrations mean nothing. They never own stock and never will. Their savings are completely protected because they have none. Nobody cares about them. In the $700 billion bailout, we saw an attempted coup of the United States government by finance. No oversight, a demand for absolute power in the tradition of the Bush administration. Their own ships sinking, the money pirates are leaping on board the taxpayers as George Bush himself sinks into irrelevancy. Secretary of the Treasury Paulson with helicopter Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve are running what's left of the country.
Congress is out. The president is impotent. Folks, this is a rudderless ship. The pilot just ejected and we're all still in the plane. It's Lord of the Flies down here.
The first bill was miraculously turned down by Congress, following a wave of emails, telephone calls against it. Maybe millions didn't turn out in public squares, but they showed up by telecommunication. That's one of the questions of this hour. Is the revolution already happening in cyberspace? Think about it. We still have the 1929 model of a depression where people line up for a run on the bank. But last week, the giant American savings and loan company, Washington Mutual, was grabbed overnight by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, due to an invisible run on the bank. People don't line up in the street anymore. WaMu depositors withdrew around $17 billion through online accounts and ATMs. The invisible bank run. It is scaring the hell out of bankers around the world. We'll also ask, which other institutions are going bankrupt? No, not those companies on Wall Street, but in Washington, D.C. and in New York City. Last I heard, the FDIC, which protects up to $100,000 of Americans' deposits in banks, had about $50 billion in reserves. Then why did the FDIC cover up to $312 billion of toxic Wachovia debt? The FDIC is already bankrupt, in my opinion, and lawmakers want to raise the limit. Christmas for everyone. And what about the Federal Reserve? Is it technically bankrupt? What about the U.S. government itself? You can be excused for believing the $700 billion bailout was defeated by the people's will last week. Not really. As we'll discover, Secretary Paulson and Federal Chair Bernanke authorized over $1 trillion of purchases of toxic debt using mechanisms your newspaper and television reporters didn't even cover. These men and their Wall Street cronies went against the will of Congress and did the bailout anyway by other means, and I'll tell you how they did it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking, but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. I want to tell you what has been done in the last few days and why it was done and what the next steps are going to be.
With nationalizations and buyout guarantees, Americans and now the citizens of Europe have bought into banking in a big way. But is a combination of banking and government really a good thing? How did that work for the Soviets? Well, just imagine the super anti-terror state with all computerized access to intelligence, police, and political files now adding all your credit records into the mix. In the future, when you are protesting something the government wants done, is it a coincidence your recent credit card application or mortgage is turned down? Get the picture? It's a nightmare slide into a kind of fascism by finance. George Bush now controls half the mortgages in America, the country's largest insurance company, and proposes to buy into the biggest banks. That gets passed on to Sarah Palin, or who knows who. And while the humans fixate on their bank accounts, our carbon deposits have never been higher. We're doing absolutely nothing about climate change. Remember Hurricane Ike? Remember Galveston, Texas, the second U.S. city to be wiped out in just 3 years? Galveston, Houston, and the floods of the season have disappeared off our screens in record time. We're all looking at Sarah Palin videos instead, like a Three Stooges rerun.
I'm not going to solely blame all of man's activities on changes in climate because the world's weather patterns are cyclical, and over history we have seen changes there. But kind of doesn't matter at this point as we debate what caused it.
Secret bailouts, finance coups, cyber revolution, and climate madness. Just another week in these times when history cracks open, unable to repair itself. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
The one bankruptcy at a day plan, that's not working. The one shotgun wedding day at a plan, like Citigroup or Wachovia Bank, how many of those are you going to arrange at this point? That's why traders down here are in a somewhat of a state of despair. Take a look at the big financial and commodity stocks. Brand new lows on many commodity stocks because the other trade is the global slowdown trade that's been going on. So you see.
All right, Dylan, thanks so much. We're down 8.25% right now, and you'd have to go back till 2000, really, when the bubble didn't just burst and when it exploded, to find out a day where we had a percentage decline of this magnitude, and we haven't gotten to that point level.
Warning, you're about to hear a song that uses a dirty word used by six-year-olds all over the world.
In the sky continues to turn, and Warren Buffett's got $5 billion to burn, but taking from the poor and giving to the rich won't work, no. I don't wanna pay for the shit you pulled, when I can't even pay to get my tank half full. I don't wanna spend another penny on what you did. No, no, no. I don't wanna pay for the last 8 years. I don't wanna see no crocodile tears. I don't wanna spend another dime on the likes of you, yeah. I don't wanna spend another penny on the shit you pulled.
The American mortgage meltdown has washed into banks and investment houses all over the world. Wall Street firms like Lehman and Goldman Sachs were so successful at selling so-called derivatives, packages of U.S. mortgages all rated as AAA by the official ratings companies. When this turned out to be a huge scam, from the mortgage brokers right on up through the trusted banks, Europeans, Asian, and Australian banks were left holding trillions of dollars of bad debt. Now governments in Europe are rescuing their own banks with unheard-of nationalizations and guarantees, all coming out of the taxpayers' pockets with no democratic choice about the matter. Just think how happy these Europeans are, how their love and trust of America has been undermined by the biggest financial swindle of all times, aided and abetted by the same government that brought them the fraudulent war in Iraq. Germany has plowed billions in taxpayer loot into their financial system. Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg rescued their giant Fortis Bank. Then Belgium and France had to act again, rescuing the Dexia Bank. The dominoes continued to fall in England, where the huge Bradford and Bingley Bank was nationalized overnight. The German government was forced to provide $51 billion line of credit to save its second-largest commercial property lender, Hypo Real Estate Holding AG. It was almost laughable to hear German Chancellor Angela Merkel demanding that the U.S. government step up to the plate and bail out their banking system after the failed vote in the House on Monday. Are you kidding? Why should the Americans pay for a Made in America scandal that rocked the world? Wait for the Americans to join the International Court or the Kyoto Protocol first. This is another huge factor that the media is glossing over. The big European institutions, like the Swiss bank USB, that lost tens of billions in bad investments, sold to them by Wall Street and approved by the ratings agencies like Standard & Poor's, are really angry that they got taken for a ride. And that's just the start. Now European governments are facing angry voters that have to pay for this fraud, and Australian voters the same, and Asians too. You think Iraq gave America a black eye? Just picture how these billions of people feel about paying for the Wall Street mess themselves. Don't underestimate the geopolitical changes that will happen just because of Wall Street's attempt to loot the world financial system. It may be slow, it may be underground, but governments are already talking about the demise of the American financial supremacy and a new world order built outside the failing structures developed by the U.S. since World War II. Even little Iceland was buying out their banks. Ireland took the biggest step, promising the taxpayers would guarantee every bank account in the country. For Irish banks, that is. European bankers called foul, saying this unilateral action endangered the European Banking Commission and created an unfair advantage for Irish banks. I wonder, does the Irish government guarantee cover its wealthiest citizen, the multi-billionaire owner of the Tata Empire in India, who, like other very wealthy people, became a citizen of convenience to take advantage of Ireland's lax tax laws? The government guarantees loads an estimated £400 billion of new liabilities on the Irish people. It's a race to the bottom to enslave the next generation in permanent debt. Anything for investors. In Russia, after their Monday crash, the government ordered the stock market shut down for the second time in 2 weeks. Back in America, citizens might have felt a brief victory for democracy when the initial dictatorial bailout bill was modified and then defeated on Monday. The big institutional investors punished the little people with a massive sell-off. The big boys came back the next day after their threat was manifest, and the American Senate went into a huddle to vote on another bailout bill on Wednesday night. Now, normally, according to a little-known document called the U.S. Constitution, the Senate cannot initiate spending bills, but hey, who's counting? Since the senators are not all up for election in November like their cronies in the House, they could risk the vote for their major campaign contributors, the Wall Street lobbyists. Just to add sugar to a bitter pill, the Senate added some tax breaks to the bill. What a good idea for a country going insolvent. And oh yeah, an alternative energy incentive for the Greens out there. It tastes good. All the way down. Now I mentioned that Treasury Secretary Paulson, he who would be king, and Fed Chair Bernanke had already picked the public pockets of $1 trillion this week anyway, despite being told no by Congress and the public. The $700 billion was refused Monday, but that very evening, the Federal Reserve lent out $620 billion to the banks, U.S. banks and foreign banks, to prop up the world financial system. Previously, the Fed lent maybe $40 billion overnight. Then a week ago, $188 billion overnight. And now $620 billion, and not just for overnight, if I understand their own publication correctly. The Fed statement is arcane for most of us. They will increase their 84-day loans to $225 billion from $75 billion. Then something called the Federal Open Market Committee provided, quote, an increase in swap authorization limits with the Bank of Canada, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, Denmark's National Bank, European Central Bank, Norges Bank, or the Bank of Norway, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Bank of Sweden, the Swiss National Bank, to a total of $620 billion from $290 billion previously, end quote. Of course, the Federal Reserve takes collateral for the huge sums it lends out. Those with a very long memory, say, 6 months or so, will recall that in the Bear Stearns debacle, the Fed modified the types of collateral banks or even later investment firms could leave. Mysteriously, the Fed agreed to take even the most toxic subprime Alt-A derivative blunk and give out solid U.S. treasuries or cash in return. There was a rush to dump the most poisonous financial papers into the Federal Reserve. According to an article in the Seeking Alpha blog on September 29, 2008, by Avery Goodman, quote, the Federal Reserve is a quasi-private institution capitalized and supported with taxpayer dollars. However, for years, it has been used as a slush fund for private banks on Wall Street. Over the past year, the banks managed to unload $777 billion worth, in terms of par value at maturity, of their most toxic debt paper onto the Fed balance sheet, end quote. Now let's continue with this Avery Goodman article titled, Close Down the Federal Reserve. No rational private industry player would have agreed to have its balance sheet polluted by the combined mistakes of its clients. However, according to the Wall Street Journal, the Fed was willing to take in this toxic waste collateral on a non-recourse basis, giving the banks cold hard cash or valuable T-bills in return. Non-recourse is a legal term which means that if the borrower fails to pay back the loan, the only thing the Fed can do is to sell the collateral. The other assets of the bank are immune from the attachment. The bad collateral consists of mortgage-backed paper and other currently depressed paper instruments, worth about 22 cents on the dollar or much less on the free market. I use the 22-cent figure because that is the price obtained at a recent sale of such assets by Citigroup. Yet in spite of the free market value of this collateral, and the 22 cents on the dollar is being very liberal about the valuation, the Federal Reserve has paid 90% of par value for this trash. Lehman Brothers is an example of a bank which was allowed to use its close connections at the New York branch of the Federal Reserve to borrow tens of billions of dollars based on bad collateral. During the time it borrowed money, everyone had to know, including Timothy Geithner, president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, that the company was insolvent. Now Lehman is officially bankrupt. It will never pay back the debt. In short, under the leadership of a board of governors heavily influenced by Wall Street, the Fed has already managed to lose a fortune of taxpayer money. End quote. Well, there you have it. Wall Street got the Federal Reserve to eat three-quarters of a trillion dollars of garbage. The American taxpayers will eat the bill. Moving on from the Federal Reserve, that headquarters of capitalism, we find another government-backed institution, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, also being fed more toxic trash for you and your descendants to pay off. This one really sucks. Every lowly citizen of America counts on the FDIC to at least give cover to up to $100,000 of their bank accounts should some banksters make off with their hard-earned savings. The FDIC doesn't have anything like that kind of money should a string of major banks fail. This week, instead of having to pay off the depositors, the FDIC has declared two banks insolvent, grabbed them overnight, and marched them off to a shotgun marriage to still larger banks. Thus, Washington Mutual was sucked into J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wachovia went to Citigroup. It's a huge concentration of the banking industry. Even though, by law, no American bank is allowed to hold more than 10% of deposits, another alleged protection for depositors and the public, we emerge this week with wholly a third of deposits held by just three banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase. For the press, FDIC officials bragged about the shuffling off bad banks with no hit to the taxpayers. Then we find out the FDIC swallowed $312 billion in toxic mortgage debt liability in the Wachovia deal alone. That's right, the FDIC, guardian of the people's money, took the very unusual route of guaranteeing $312 billion of the worst mortgages and so-called underperforming assets to Citigroup. In fact, Citigroup stands to make out like bandits from the Wall Street bailout if it's passed by the Senate or the House and the financial woes. On September 29th, Sarah Lepro, business writer for the AP Wire Service, reported, quote, "The government's proposed $700 billion rescue plan for financial institutions being voted on Monday by the House of Representatives will likely prove of added benefit to Citi. While the plan broadly aims to prevent banks from profiting on the sale of troubled assets to the government, there is an exception made for assets acquired in a merger or buyout or from companies that have filed for bankruptcy. This could allow Citigroup to sell toxic mortgages and other assets it gained from Wachovia for a higher price than the bank actually paid for them." End quote. Now the elite chorus is calling for even higher limits of protection from the FDIC, which is already technically insolvent, in my opinion. The Senate wants to raise the limits to $250,000. Kramer, the same idiot who told viewers to buy Wachovia stock the very night the bank disappeared into thin air, Kramer wants $1 million of coverage from the taxpayer.
Jim Cramer is now also here. So, Jim, you know who's part of the conversation. Right. What's your view right now?
If we don't get, there's one organization that is still trusted even after what happened today with Citigroup and Wachovia, and that's the FDIC. The FDIC must immediately say that we will no longer just protect 100,000. We'll protect up to 1 million. Anybody who wants individual protection, a large corporation for more than that, the bank should kick in a little bit of fee to the FDIC, maybe even 0.25%, so that the FDIC can say, listen, we're guaranteeing hundreds of millions of dollars if you want it. We got to get not just injected funds. We got to get corporations to continue to be willing to bank. Mm-hmm. And right now they don't. Otherwise, as I said on my show last night, we're going to go down another 2,500 points, and we'll go down the 2,500 points rather quickly.
Hell, why not cover everything, everywhere? Guarantees for all. It's the invisible hand of capitalism. In my mind, I keep hearing James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency, in the speech I recorded last January. Here are a few clips from that two-hour session, which you can find in our archive of past Radio EcoShock programs. Kunstler saw this all coming, and why?
Because as you know, as this problem got closer to us, you saw a lot of really inexplicable behavior on the part of people working in finance. You know, most notably for the last 10 years down in the United States, all the bankers in the United States forgot that you need to lend money to people who have some prospect for paying it back.
Jim, you made a comment that as we kind of go over the hump into the next world, that we're going to have a big shortage of capital. And yet at the same time, you made the comment where we've never sat on so much wealth as we have at the end of the 20th century and now. I'm trying to equate both of those things together.
Well, what's clearly happening, even as I speak, is that capital is evaporating in huge gobs. This week, I mean, we have the stock markets this week around the world have lost $1.5 trillion worth of notional wealth, or to put it another way, of wealth that 2 weeks ago was assumed to be there, and which all of a sudden is not there anymore. So, yeah. But I would also add that, you know, we also created a lot of real capital and a lot of real wealth. It's just in this period of financial hypertrophy in the last, you know, 10 years or so, we stopped creating real wealth and started creating hallucinated wealth. And that's where you get, you know, a lot of the tricks and gambits that the guys were running, on Wall Street, creating securities and financial instruments that were abstruse, that were incomprehensible, that were to some degree fraudulent. I mean, one of the things we've actually, you know, when you really get down to it, one of the things we've really seen in the last 10 years is simply a huge swindle. It just doesn't seem that way to most people because the prosecutors haven't been called in yet. You know, but the time may come when they will be, and that we will understand what happened as a swindle. Well, there's certainly a valid case to be made that the certificates and paper and financial instruments and securities that we trade in and use to represent wealth are being challenged by reality, and they're losing their legitimacy. You know, the dollar, the U.S. dollar, has been losing its legitimacy for the last 5 years. That is losing value. People don't believe it has as much value as it pretends to, so it goes down, you know, a hundredth of a cent every week against the euro and bounces back a little bit, then it goes down further. It's against the Canadian dollar at two, et cetera, et cetera. And, I think there's a great deal of fear that we're on the verge of a kind of a financial crisis that will leave all of these certificates worthless. And then people will have no idea what to trade in. And even actually before that happens, the credit markets will become extremely defensive as they have become. They'll seize up in the sense that they They won't lend money out to anybody because they will, in the case of many of the banks now, you know, one of the things that's happened is that there's no transparency anymore in the sense that nobody really knows what anybody else really has. And the bankers are afraid to lend money to other banks and to institutions because they're not sure whether these banks are insolvent or not, whether these institutions are insolvent. And so what's really going on out there is a great fear of true insolvency, of people, you know, of institutions really not having any resources. And I can just agree with you. It's a very dangerous period. We don't know how this is going to shake out, you know, what kind of conditions it can lead to. But the, you know, the story that I find most credible is really what's called a, you know, a deflationary situation, which essentially means an awful lot of people in institutions are broke, and they're selling off whatever assets they can. And you end up in a society that's become a fire sale of assets, and it's a lot of assets with no buyers because nobody's got the money. And you know, that's what's going on in the housing sector in the United States now. And the last time this happened, we called it the Great Depression. And the last time we had a Great Depression, we got over it, but not until the Second World War was over. And that whole travail went on for 15 years. It was a true crisis of capital, but it was different that time in some ways, and in some ways that are a little bit scary. When we had the first Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt actually said it. You know, he said the great mystery of it was there was want amidst plenty. Because it was a failure of banking and a failure of lending and a failure of debt and a failure of paying back debt and a failure of a lot of financial things, but we still had a lot of stuff. We had a lot of oil in the United States. We had a lot of metals. We had a lot of resources. We had a lot of grains. We had a lot of manpower. We had a lot of big and beautiful cities that had not been destroyed yet. We had a lot of everything, but we didn't have a lot of money moving around the system. It was different in some additional ways. A lot of the people in the United States at that time had just come from the farm and gone to the big cities. You know, 20% of the population was still out there on the farm, and people could go back to the farm and live in conditions of monetary austerity, and just not, you know, have much money to spend, but they would have live chickens that they could, you know, slaughter, and eggs to eat, and vegetables that they could grow in their backyards or their farm, on their farms, and have commodities even to sell and to trade. But this time, you know, that's not the case. Only, you know, a tiny fraction of the population is out there doing that. So, yeah, I think that that's... I think the big question for the, you know, for the layman who follows this really right now is it a hyperinflationary situation or is it a deflationary situation? And there are a lot of interesting arguments. Many of them appear valid on both sides, you know. And I come down on the side of probably a deflationary, extreme deflationary problem. And down in the United States, you know, I think that a picture is resolving that we have a nation of extremely passive and complacent, entitled citizens who are going to be very ticked off as these things occur, and they're not going to know what to do. They're going to be paralyzed, and they're going to beg somebody to push them around. And, you know, that's the thing that worries me. It's not going to be George Bush. It'll be some corn-pone Nazi, you know, some Huckabee kind of guy. Those are the kinds of things that trouble my sleep. And so these things could start, you know, evolving into a dangerous revolutionary situation.
Find that two-part speech at ecoshock.org from James Howard Scull. The End of the Age of Oil, Part 1 and Part 2, was broadcast in early February 2008. Or you can go to Kunstler.com to get some of James Howard Kunstler's great podcasts and other materials. He's got really the big picture on what's happening, not only with peak oil, but with the economy and the fraudsters who've been running it. Okay, now this is a bit embarrassing, but I'm going to play you a clip from one of my earliest radio programs in October 2006, where I go into a blog posting by James Howard Kunstler called Swan Dive, where he predicts the fall of the stock market for reasons of peak oil. Kunstler was embarrassed when the stock market did not fall at that time, but I thought his reasoning could be right. And so I'm going to play you this clip in my early beginnings of radio. This is a commentary on current events by the author of The Long Emergency, James Howard Kunstler, also found on www.kunstler.com. That's spelled K-U-N-S-T-L-E-R.com. Swan Dive, October 9th, 2006. Against the background of everything else happening in the financial markets is the apparent circumstance of peak oil. Even the New York Times joined in a chorus of the Sunday editorial saying, "Our demand for petroleum products strains the limits of the global capacity to supply them. In past decades, if a pipeline broke in Nigeria, Saudi Arabia might compensate by setting workers to pumping more oil. Now, with little additional capacity, rising prices are necessary to balance out supply and demand." End quote. No more increasing capacity equals peak oil. It's as simple as that. We now have 9.5 months of rear-view mirror action to look back and see that the world oil production has retreated from its all-time high of just over 85 million barrels a day, achieved in December 2005, just as geologist Ken DeFays of Princeton had predicted. For 2006, production has remained in the 84 million barrels a day range every month reported so far, while demand has exceeded that. Texas oil man Jeffrey Brown, a commentator at theoildrum.com, the outstanding oil discussion group on the internet, makes the point that Saudi Arabia is at the same point statistically, in terms of ultimate recoverable reserves, that Texas was in 1972 when production there peaked. The world's four greatest oil fields are in depletion: Bergan in Kuwait, Daqing in China, Canatrel, Mexico, and Guar in Saudi Arabia. And these have accounted for over 14% of the world's oil production. Guar alone accounts for over 60% of Saudi Arabia's production. The North Sea has peaked and production there is crashing. Venezuela has peaked and its oil is shitty heavy crude. Indonesia, an OPEC member, has peaked and is now a net oil importer. Nigeria's political chaos is making production increasingly difficult to impossible. Production in the Canadian tar sands is not making up for losses elsewhere. The U.S. is down to about a 4-year supply of conventional crude and condensates, while we import 70% of the oil we consume. Discovery of new oil, including Chevron's largely hypothetical deepwater Jack finds, is barely covering a fraction of the world's consumption. So it goes. Where finance is concerned, the basic implication of peak oil is pretty stark: an end to industrial expansion, i.e., growth. All the alternatives to oil will not keep the industrial economies expanding, so they can only slow down a contraction, and only marginally so. The trouble with this picture is that finance is a system that uses paper markers to represent the hope and expectation for the expansion of wealth. These markets are currencies, stocks, bonds, option contracts, derivatives plays, and other certificates that are traded in open markets. If there is no longer any hope of increased wealth in the world, then all those tradable paper markets become losers. Their value unwinds, and imagined piles of wealth evaporate into thin air. The unwinding process depends on the psychology of the people who own these certificates. If they do not understand the global oil situation and its implications, then they will continue to hope for and expect expanded wealth, and thus continue to regard their paper certificates as credible markers of wealth. And that is largely the case at the moment, since most of the players in the financial markets are not paying attention to the peak oil story or don't believe it is for real. Two special and transient circumstances are now propping up the financial markets. One is that for practical purposes, the world is virtually at peak, meaning this is an extra special time of strange behavior, like the point in the apogee of a steep suborbital flight in which passengers become momentarily weightless. Supply and demand for oil are only beginning to go out of whack, that is, demand just barely exceeding supply. Even at this early stage, the oil markets themselves are showing stress as hoarding behavior sets in and induces wider swings of price volatility. But these swings in oil prices, such as the one we're in right now, where prices have crashed 20% since the panic buying, hoarding of June and July, send false signals to the financial players. The main false signal is that all is well on the global oil scene. There is no supply problem, and hence no threat to the continuing expansion of industrial production and its associated wealth-generating activities. This signal just tells the players to buy more paper markers, thus the stock market goes up. The second special and transient circumstance is that so much wealth has already accumulated along the way to peak, that financial markets take on a life of their own, as existing wealth invests itself in more paper markets, hoping and expecting to grow into even more wealth. The problem here is that existing wealth is actually being squandered, since the paper markers will only lose value as the hopes and expectations vested in them dissolve in disappointment. But we haven't quite reached that point yet. In simply bidding the markets up, the system has spun off even more gobs of presumed wealth. Some of this liquidity, say in the checking accounts of people who work for Goldman Sachs, has found its way into Manhattan condominiums or Aspen McMansions and filtered through the system to everyone from the lawyers who write up the prenuptial agreements to the guys who sell the furniture to the people who drive the delivery trucks that bring it to the door to the men laying tiles in the new bathrooms. The basic insanity of the system that presumes vastly increased wealth where none will occur, has led to further distortions in finance. The most obvious one is the so-called housing bubble. The misplaced extreme expectation in the ever-increasing value of paper wealth led to the hijacking of mortgages by financial players who bundled them into odd lots of tradable debt, promises to pay, and used them to leverage abstruse bets, hedges, on the behavior of other kinds of paper markets, currencies, interest rate differentials, commodity prices. Very profitably, as long as all the players believed that industrial society that run all oil would continue to grow to produce more wealth. The level of abstraction in these rackets, their distance from the reality of productive activity, is self-evident. But they were so successful that the profligate creation of even more mortgages became an increasingly reckless and irresponsible enterprise. Contracts were made with house buyers who had no record of creditworthiness and often no real proof of income. Contracts were made on terms, interest payments, that were deceptive, even ruinously false for house buyers. The reckless reassignment of lending risk into even more abstract layers of deferred obligation and the ease of credit that ensued allowed millions of ordinary people to acquire real property on unrealistic terms, which had the effect of bidding up the price of houses that these owners will eventually have to surrender for non-payment. That process is now underway. The reckless creation of mortgages had the further effect of stealing demand for house building from the future. So many new houses were built and then sold to people who will probably have to surrender them. And then so many more beyond that were built in the expectation and hope that reckless mortgage creation would continue forever, that there is now a massive oversupply of total existing houses, while the pool of suckers for new ruinous mortgages has shrunk to zero. Similar excesses in all the other lending and debt sectors, including non-performing credit card obligations and government deficits, will also unwind and thunder through the system. Meanwhile, the false signal from the oil markets that has been broadcasting for 8 weeks will come offline and a new signal will come on as prices go back up. The pause in bidding for future oil induced by the panic overbuying of the summer will end. The heating season is here, It's 40 degrees out in upstate New York this morning, and the furnace is cranking. The Chinese and the Indians and even the people in France have not stopped using oil, even if Americans have put their Winnebagos up on blocks for the season. As the price of oil goes back up, the financial markets will get a new signal that running industrial societies has just gotten more expensive again. That will dampen hopes and expectations for increased wealth from these societies. Meanwhile, the air will be coming out of millions of mortgages, and the loss of value will spread among players holding these bundles of mortgage debt, i.e., promises that money spent on houses is being paid back, which it won't be. And at the same time, the houses themselves will lose value as the pool of potential buyers shrinks to nothing. That is, the inflated high price of these assets will deflate. As this occurs, there will be far fewer wage earners putting up additional houses, fewer furniture sales, fewer trips by delivery trucks, and fewer tile jobs in the McBathrooms. That is why I view the fall melt-up of the stock market as a swan dive. We're at the apogee now, just as the world is at the apogee of its oil production. I confess, I thought the reality of our economic predicament would be recognized by the players and their markets sooner than it has. It turns out the chief luxury of the final cheap oil blowout has been the artificial support of unrealistic hopes and expectations. That was written by Jim Kunstler, the author of The Long Emergency, on October 9, 2006, and read out to you by Alex Smith of Radio Eco Shock. So the Wall Street debacle continues and taxpayers are asked for more and more. Grow yourself big, little piggies, at the taxpayer's risk. Where can I get a bailout? I guess I have to toss a few more million dollars into my congressman and senator to get some action. What we have here is a total disconnect between the average citizen and the elites who claim to manage the economy. As the toilet flushes pensions, investments, and rules down the drain, the scamsters take in more power and money. It is now impossible to see any dividing line between a tiny elite of billionaires and the government of the people. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As the marriage of billionaires and the federal government goes ahead, following the rape of the future and the common worker, this passion play works out two ways. Not only has Wall Street captured the government, but the government is increasingly capturing control of banking. And why not? They print the fake money anyway. There are minor problems. For example, if the government is supposed to regulate a big company like AIG, but also owns 80% of it, how does that work? Not that there has been any effective regulation, as we now see. The ultimate danger, as critics like Paul Craig Roberts warn, is a new kind of financial fascism. The Bush administration has set many dangerous precedents about interference with civil liberties. They spy on people both legally and illegally. Now they're going to get your banking records and have control of a huge portion of the lending pie. You can see the risk that Big Brother will react to criticism or protests or any kind of civil disobedience by quietly lowering your credit worthiness. Suddenly, you can't get a car loan or a mortgage. Don't laugh this off. The federal government now owns more than half of all the mortgages in the United States and is claiming interest in various banks, insurance companies, and more. The same applies in Great Britain, which is already the world's most developed spy state when it comes to its own citizens. Now the UK has nationalized several large banks, beginning with Northern Rock and continuing on, with more to come. What is this new financial government hybrid emerging before our eyes? How will it be used by a Sarah Palin or who knows who? How will rogue government agencies abuse your savings or credit line? Who could stop them? Too paranoid? Just remember the Red Scare of the 1950s right in America, the land of the free. Librarians were fired, executives, government workers, because they at one time went to a Communist Party meeting. Left-leaning journalists were fired. Folk singer Pete Seeger was banned from American TV for decades. Now they won't have to be so obvious. They can just decline your card at the checkout stand. Good luck with your life outside the electronic grid now that the government and the banks are one and the same. So much is going unreported. What happens to the millions of Americans losing their homes? Where are they going? Do you know Congress did manage to do some work this week? They gave $25 billion in rescue loans to the auto industry. General Motors can't borrow anywhere else. Their credit rating has dropped below junk bond status. The car companies don't have to repay this money for 5 years. Any bets any of them will be around then? Do you really believe any of this $25 billion will be paid back by anybody other than you? Car sales have slumped around the world, and thanks be. Maybe it will help the atmosphere breathe long enough to find another way to get around without wrecking the climate. Oh yeah, and Congress quickly approved another $620 billion for the military, much of it due to the Iraq war. Hey, I have an idea. Why not close the overseas bases and use the $620 billion to rescue Americans in debt? Here is Dmitry Orlov from a Radio EcoShock interview last spring.
But I identified a few things that I thought would be worth doing, just basically in an effort to prevent disasters that are avoidable. One of those, for instance, is not letting troops, American troops, which are scattered all over the globe, become stranded overseas, sometimes in hostile lands, sometimes in indifferent lands, and not letting their weapons fall into the wrong hands. The United States maintains over 1,000 military bases around the world. A lot of them don't actually serve much of a purpose, and they require a functioning civilian economy in order to resupply those bases. They're not self-sufficient. They use copious amounts of fossil fuels, basically oil-derived things like gasoline and diesel. And that is really not something that this country will be able to keep going after the economy shuts down. So I would see, I would think that repatriating those soldiers as soon as possible, shutting down and cleaning up the bases, bringing all this war material back into the United States or destroying it, these are all excellent ideas.
All this reckless spending, deficit spending, money America hasn't got, the government will hawk the future to the Saudis, the Chinese, who knows who. Either of those two could pull the plug at any time, and guess what? They don't love America all that much. It's not like America can keep borrowing forever. Again, here's Dmitry Orlov.
Now, the thing to keep in mind is that it's really all built around oil. There's very little that can happen economically in the United States that does not require oil. And if we, say, wanted to build something that doesn't run on oil, right, that runs on solar or hydro or you know, horse manure or what have you, you have to go and take out a loan. Now, what's going to be the collateral for that loan? Well, it's going to be things that run on oil, right? Jet aircraft, heavy equipment, what have you. And as you're constructing that thing, you're going to be using oil. So it's not likely that all of that equipment that burns oil is going to be very valuable as collateral if oil is in short supply. So you won't get that loan. So basically all of those things put together mean that there isn't really much of a future for an economy in the United States of the size that exists today. It's going to be much smaller. Now, a smaller economy cannot maintain and service a huge debt. So that means bankruptcy.
The White House is empty. The banksters are clearing out the last gold from the Treasury. And where are the riots in the streets? Even the Washington Post asked, where have all the protests gone? Are the students too in debt to speak up? California lefty Tom Hayden wondered the same thing this summer when I recorded his speech in Vancouver.
It does seem to me that universities around the world are being privatized and the cost is going up. I went to university for $100 a year. And now you kind of join the chain gang thinking that it's a privilege. You go to university, you go into debt, and you live for a very long time in debt. And I think this accounts in many ways for the decline of discretionary time for revolution or protest or even free thinking. But also it explains, you know, many of the circumstances that disturb or even alienate people today. There was an article in the New York Times today, I believe, that said, my generation is aging in the faculty, and that was a good thing because we're being replaced by moderates. And there was a lot of discussion of what a moderate was, but if I read the article carefully, the difference was that the 60s professors were driven by values, according to the New York Times, and the current professors are driven by data. And that's the world I've really looked forward to bringing about, you know, from dreams to data.
Washington Post writer David Siegel quotes Rachel McMillan, a senior at Columbia University, saying, "Most college students just don't feel like they have a vested interest in what is happening today," she said. "I hate to say it, but a lot of my peers calculate the opportunity costs of coordinating with others or planning a sit-in or a walkout or just some protest against the urge to write a paper, get an A, and go to Harvard Law School," end quote. Radio EcoShock goes out to at least 9 college radio stations that I know of. You tell me, why are college students letting the baby boomers take all your future taxes now? For wars, and now to repay bad debts by Wall Street gamblers. Is anybody out there? Write me at radio@ecoshock.org. As I said earlier in this broadcast, there is a chance, just a chance, that protest is happening, but not like anything known in the 60s. The old models are dying, as Robert Jensen said. Facebook is sizzling. Blogs are humming. Emails to members of the House nearly shut down the government system for the first time by sheer volume last Monday as the vote came down on the bailout. We accept that the financial world has moved to computers. Could it be social change has gone there as well? Is there a silent revolution already happening in cyberspace? I slogged through Blogland using Technorati. Google yielded little. YouTube a little bit more. But basically, even given the complete lack of coverage by the major media and their corporations, it still sounds like a lot of silence to me. If I were in a place of power these days, in a corporation, a bank, or government, I'd be very worried about that silence. It could be the lull before a storm, which will bring down the house. With all this excitement, does anyone even remember Hurricane Ike? There are still 400 people unaccounted for. Galveston is still a wreck, another Gulf City gone. Scientific experts, American and internationally, say climate disruption is just beginning. More cities will be destroyed or damaged around the world. We know it. But climate disruption is not even mentioned in the presidential debates. Oh yeah, Obama said the word climate once. It's off the radar. It's not happening. Humans have such short attention spans. We are easily distracted by bank crashes and wars or just the latest celebrity scandal. We're only interested in ourselves, not in the disappearance of the natural world. We're screwed, as late-night talk show host David Letterman explains in his recent rant. That's coming up in a second, but first, thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I approve this message. Next week, I'll shut up and play you a hot new speech from Paul Ehrlich. He came out in the late 60s with the book The Population Bomb and has been publishing bestsellers ever since. His latest, co-authored with his wife Anne, is The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. On September 24th, I recorded his speech at the University of British Columbia, and you won't want to miss it. Here is Paul Ehrlich on The Bailout.
You know, you shouldn't knock neocons because they've all turned into socialists. You know, they spent the last 20 or 30 years trying to remove all regulation on financial instruments in the United States, and they pressured some people that I know. For instance, you got to remember that in this mess, there are a lot of poor people who really got screwed. They were sold mortgages they couldn't possibly afford because they didn't understand the conditions and so on. They take these dodgy mortgages and put them together, a whole bunch of lousy debt, into packages, which they then are transformed into structured investment vehicles and sold around and so on. And all of a sudden, the whole mess goes down the drain, and the people who, besides the people who've been screwed, the people who are the neocons, are losing money. And so what do? They want a $700 billion bailout, not from you guys, but it'll catch up with you too, from the citizens of the United States, from the very victor, very victim. So I'm a little bit annoyed.
The elections, the climate, population, the idiocy, and threats to our whole human project next week with Paul Ehrlich on Radio EcoShock. Won't you join us then? Okay, it's time for David Letterman.
Now look at this. Here's a guy that's written this book. His name is Thomas Friedman. He writes for the New York Times. And I know you're saying, that rag. But... This is all about something that has concerned me for quite some time, which is the climate change or your global warming. And I'll be honest with you, in the beginning, I thought it was kooks. I thought it was people running around who didn't have any idea what they were talking about. I thought it was your tree huggers.
Oh, the tree.
But here lately, within the last 10 years, I've been persuaded that something is hinky. And by God, you can quote me on that.
I shall.
Something is hinky. I mean, when the average temperature of February is 68 degrees here in New York City,
yeah,
that ain't right.
No.
And anyway, so now here's a guy who's going to tell us, and believe me, he's optimistic. I'm not. I think it's too late. I mean, how many hurricanes have we had in the last week? What 20? 25?
Yeah, at least.
I mean, we're talking about lousy killer hurricanes. A half an hour ago, and I have a seismic monitoring station in my home. A half an hour ago, I get a call, and a size of the state of Rhode Island of ice busted off the South Pole ice shelf.
I heard about that.
You can see how upset I am about it.
Well, no, of course.
I can almost not find the word.
Can't even get your words straight.
That's right. For a long time, I thought that they were keeping something from us, and I thought what it was that we were actually, we'd busted out of our orbit and were hurtling toward the sun. Well, thank God it's not that,
yeah.
But it might as well be that.
Yeah.
And here's something else people say, you know, we're doing what we can whenever we have party toothpicks at the house. We try to use them again. Fine. Use them again. Doesn't make any... Here's what we like to do. Whenever Larry mows the yard, we save the clippings for mulch. Makes no difference, ladies and gentlemen.
Not
until
anymore.
We get the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, we're screwed. We are walking dead people. We are the lost civilization. You're looking at us right here.
That's it.
Time to go. The cab is coming.
My ride is here.
Yeah. And then Letterman was shooting his mouth off about climate change. We went to the Letterman show and he wouldn't shut up about climate. Can we have another pitcher of margaritas? Well, anyway, maybe we'll knock some sense into some people here tonight.
Yeah, that's not so.
But Thomas Friedman will come out here and say, no, it's not too late. We got to get to work. I'll tell you why it's too late. We've had no leadership. Let's say this began in 1980. We have had no leadership. Nobody in the White House, no Republican, no Democrat, nobody has stepped forward. Why can't this be like John Kennedy? We're all running around worried about the Russians coming to get us with spy satellites and stuff. So he says, I'll tell you what, here's a way to erase the fear of the Russians. We'll go to the moon. So we go to the moon. Everybody loves it. Everybody was happy about it. Everybody went out and bought a thing for their head.
Yeah.
And so one of two things, we did space exploration, everybody's a winner, and nobody was worried about the Russians. So
right.
It was a win-win.
Win-win.
Why? We haven't had leadership.
No.
Nobody has come forth. People are embarrassed to talk about it because
right.
They got all their big oil buddies.
Big oil.
Big oil. But I'll tell you something, forget big oil. We don't have enough oil to even worry about anymore. Not here in the North America, not even in the world. It's that we have to find alternative forms of energy. And... thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. On the other hand, I don't even know why I'm talking about this because it's too late. We are dead meat.
Dead meat.
Oh, well, let's try and have some fun now.
Sure, yeah. Let the games begin.
Let the games begin. That's right. Well, you know, it's good to see. How about that Republican convention? And by the way, the Republicans have taken climate change out of their platform. As far as they're concerned, everything's fine.
Yeah.
96 in March? Yeah, just how we like it.
Yeah.
If everybody in the world right now began riding bicycles, leave your limo in the garage, everybody, bicycles, and we cut carbon emissions 100%. No more carbon emission. And that was improving the layer of carbon around the atmosphere. If everybody did that, the planet, and you're thinking, well, that would be great, wouldn't it? Yes, it would be great. But the planet would continue to heat at precipitous levels for 60 years. We are so screwed!